Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I am the founder of Mixergy, home of the ambitious upstart. And this is a story of an entrepreneur who took less than 6 hours to build a site that now attracts 40 million monthly users. His name is Tom Lehman. You see him up on your screen. He is the co-founder of Rap Genius, a company dedicated to annotating and interpreting lyrics. I invited him here to talk about how he did it. This interview is sponsored by Scott Edward Walker of WalkerCorporateLaw.com, but I'll tell you more about Scott later. For now, I want to welcome Tom. Tom, welcome.
Woo! Great to be here. Big fan. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. You know what? It means a lot to me, too, that you're not just a guy who's here doing the interview, but you're a fan who's heard my past interviews.
Patio 11. Big ups to Patio 11. Love him. Great guy. Big inspiration.
Patrick McKenzie, he did the interview here when he was living in Japan, when he was, I think it was soon after he quit his job, after reading about startups, building his company, and you were in the audience. So cool that you were in the audience watching. Hey, took less than 6 hours to build a site, and the reason I kind of rushed through that intro is because it just felt so gimmicky, and I just realized after reading it that I couldn't stand by my own intro. So let's explain it a little bit. It took 6 hours, partially because time in that you put into a previous site called Better Metro North. What was Better Metro North, and is actually?
Right, so Better Metro North is a website. It's bettermetronorth.com. It's still up and running today, and it's a website that makes it very easy to get train schedules on Metro North Railroad, which is a train system that runs throughout New York and Connecticut. And the germ of the idea came, I was actually visiting some friends who were at Yale Law School at the time, and I was trying to decide whether to go to law school. And while I was there, I was like, I definitely don't want to go to law school. And so I was sitting in on a class that was making the final decision that I didn't want to go to law school. And in the class, I was like, well, I've got to get the train to go home. And the website was really bad. And I was like, all right, I can, you know, hack something together to do better. And so in that class, I like hacked it together. And then kind of refined it and eventually released it as like a standalone site. It still exists today. It you know, basically grabs the schedule from Metro North's website, which is ugly and hard to use. It requires you to go to one page to get the schedule, another page to get fare information, and it compiles schedules and fares together in a very nice little table that shows it to the user. And you can click reverse trip to see the way it trains on the way back. And so Better Metro North was this project I was building. I was kind of in a mode at the time of building a lot of projects on the web. Like, you know, I just really got into programming, and, you know, I also wanted to quit my job and, you know, like Patrick McKenzie. Be like Patrick McKenzie.
He was a salary man, too, and he was looking to quit. Yeah. Your model, though, wasn't to find one thing. You wanted to build, what was it, 20 different products? You wanted to do, what was the strategy that would eventually lead you to the business that would help you get out of the working life?
Sure. So I was, I didn't know, you know, what I ultimately wanted to build. I also had collaborators. Like, I was working very closely at the time with my close friend and roommate, Alon, who's one of the other Rap Genius co-founders. And then, you know, Mopod, the third Rap Genius co-founder, I didn't work on the pre-Rap Genius projects with, but he was there from the very first day on Rap Genius. And we were kicking around ideas, and I remember thinking to myself, okay, I built a couple of things online. You know, at that point, I had built Better Metro North. There was a website called Bomb Sheets, which was the easiest way to buy bed sheets online, which solves a problem I'm sure you've had of going into Bed Bath & Beyond and having a nervous breakdown at the sight of all the different options for sheets and not knowing like which is good. So it's great sheets, no hassle. Fliff was another thing we built. This was a kind of a proto-Venmo, a way of tracking debts and paying off debts between roommates. The idea came to mind when Alon and I were moving to get in together, and you know, he had to pay for the movers and I had to pay the security deposit. We were like, how do we... and then Better Metro North. And so I was like, you know what, I built four things online. None of them really took off, but they're all pretty cool. Like, if I build 20 things online, by that point, something is bound to take off. So I'm not going to worry about it. I'm just going to build one thing after another and then see what takes off. And the thing after Better Metro North, Rap Genius, which was, in some sense, the worst idea of them all, or the most distant from the idea of a business, ended up taking off, although it didn't really... seemed that way at the time. It took a long time before it really seemed clear that it was going.
How would you know that that one of these tests would work? What was going to be your yardstick?
Well, that's what's funny about it, is the actual test was wrong, which was that it's not good to build 20 different things and see what takes off, because the way things fail is not because the idea is bad. The way things fail is because you quit. And so with Bomb Sheets, you know, we built Bomb Sheets. I programmed it, and then Alon, and actually we were collaborating with another current Rap Geniuser, Todd, you know, we put bomb sheets out there, and we didn't get a ton of traction. Like, not a bunch of people bought sheets, although people did buy sheets. So that's like, you know, if you can put up a website and have someone, you know, whose uterus you've never been in contact with, like, you're not your mom, i.e., like, buy something from them, that's very hard. So, you know, that's cool, but we didn't get a lot of traction, and so what we did was we quit, you know, and we quit after about 4 or 5 months, and, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean bomb sheets was a bad idea. It was a bad idea in that iteration, but if we had kept working on it, if we had kept pushing and iterating on it, maybe it would become something. And so in a lot of ways, Rap Genius succeeded only because we decided not to quit. We kept working on it because the first, you know, 14, 15, 16 months of Rap Genius was, you know, looks like a total failure, you know? So not quitting is a big, important thing in being successful.
You know what? It does seem like bomb sheets is the one that...
A long way to go. Sorry.
Sorry?
I just want to say, I think that's... not quitting is important in being successful, but I don't want to say that, like, I'm successful now because, like, you know, it's day one for Rap Genius today. Like, we've got a way long way to go before I'm willing to call, like, Rap Genius a true success. But getting a little taste of, like, traction, you know...
And I want to spend some time here really diving into what got it from the idea to where it is today. But I have to ask you about bomb sheets because it does seem like a regret of yours. And I'm wondering, of all the different things that you tried, why do you feel like bomb sheets, where you spent months on it, is the one that you could have spent even more time on?
Well, bomb sheets was just the most recent one. And it was the one that, like, had, you know, I could have spent more time with Better Metro North, too. I mean, you know, maybe, like, when I put Better Metro North out there, people were like, what about the Long Island Railroad? I was like, version 2, you know? So I could have done more with that. Bomb Sheets is one I could have definitely done more. It's not Bomb Sheets in particular. It's any idea that you build and put out there that doesn't become a big thing is either not a big thing because it's just not a great direction and you shouldn't pursue it and it's not going to be a big thing, or it is a great direction and you should pursue it. It's just going to take a lot of work and suffering and toiling and obscurity to make it a big thing, and there's no way to know, like, ahead of time, I feel, or at least I don't know. And so that's why I think a big thing is you shouldn't work on something for 4 months and then think, oh, God, like, you know, I went to college. I deserve instant success. Like, so you're not going to get it. So don't quit. Or maybe quit until you, you know, find the right thing and then don't quit. But we could have easily quit Rap Genius. There were times we came very close to quitting Rap Genius, in fact. I remember there was one lunch when Alon and I were at lunch, and I was basically telling him, yeah, you know, the thing about Rap Genius is, from a technical standpoint, I think it's done. I think I've basically finished it. Like, it is what it is. It's fine. You know, maybe we should go back and work on Bomb Sheets again. Like, we had a lunch where we literally, like, talked about that and seriously entertained it. And that was, like, you know, many months into the project. So we could have quit Rap Genius easily, you know. So don't quit if it's good.
It occurs to me that you're a guy who's in Rap Genius, who's into entrepreneurship, but before you worked at D.E. Shaw & Company. And I could never fit in... I can never understand how someone who's so free-spirited, who's so entrepreneurial, who's so into maybe not music as much as your co-founders, you said, but dancing. How do you work at a company like D.E. Shaw? I tried to do that when I left college, and I couldn't bring myself to do it. And I'm not nearly as relaxed and you know, comfortable with my – I definitely wasn't at the time – as you are with yourself. How do you fit in with an environment like D.E. Shaw?
Sure, I mean, it's a good question. You know, to this day, I've got a ton of love for D. Shaw, and D. Shaw taught me a ton of things. And, you know, I think the answer is that, I think one thing that made D. Shaw very, not only tolerable, but in some ways great, at least in the earlier days, was that people there were not totally like-minded in temperament and interest, but most of the people there were like-minded in terms of obsession with, like, doing a good job and, like, quality and driven, being driven. And so, you know, when I was there, you know, and this is before I knew how to program, I joined, and I learned to program there. Why? Because I was doing various systems administration tasks, and there'd be people there who were really driven and really, you know, good at using programming tools to help, and they would teach me that stuff. And then, you know, when I went on to be a product manager, like, the standard of quality when you're, like, designing a feature or giving feedback on a feature, like, the level of quality you needed, like, that was, like, really drilled into me as, like, a really, really good job. And, you know, just... doing a really good job, taking pride in your work, really pushing yourself, you know, that, like, even if the actual literal work isn't the most interesting thing, like, that, having, like, a sort of craft you take pride in. And also, it taught me a bunch of things. Like, you know, I learned how to program because of D. Shaw. I learned how to be a product manager because of D. Shaw. I learned a lot about how to run a company at D. Shaw. Like, at D. Shaw, I remember, one rule at D. Shaw was, when you're running a thing, you never want to put someone's individual email address on, like, a web page and say, like, if you have problems with finance, email Andrew Warner. You want to say, like, email finance. You want to say, email this mailing list. So if that person leaves the company, you'll still have, and that's like mundane stuff, or that's one mundane example, but a lot of stuff like that. Like, D-Show was a well-run place, like they took facilities, you know, very seriously. Like, you'd show up at day one, your computer would be there, your desk would be there, everything was chill if you needed a pen, and it's not like that at every company, and so, you know, that's something somewhat of an inspiration.
You know, I read the book, The Everything Store, about Jeff Bezos, and unlike Jeff Bezos' wife, I love that book. And it talks about how much he learned from D.E. Shaw about analysis, about thinking about companies and markets. Did you get any of that, too, there?
You know, not really. You know, I wasn't on the sort of finance. I was building tools that the traders and other sort of, you know, financial analyst type people use. So I got some exposure to it in terms of, like, building tools in a certain way. I would say D.E. Shaw taught me about, a lot about analyzing like situations and dynamics, but not so much about like the public markets. And, you know, I'm also a pretty big skeptic about that kind of stuff in general, even though I was working at a hedge fund. Like, you know, I don't think anyone really knows anything. So I don't know. I definitely don't know anything.
So you were in the experimental phase and you came up with the idea for Rap Genius. How?
So I was getting into rap music, you know, in high school. In college, I was never really into like rap from like a lyrical perspective. Like, you know, when I was in college, I liked to dance, like a beat you can dance to. When I was in college, like the defining songs of like my college experience were rap. Two of them being Hey Ma with Cam'ron and Joel Santana, Dipset. Truly, when I heard that song, I thought, okay, it's the end of history, like music, let's shut down music culture because we're done. This is the best song that can ever be. And then it happened again, or maybe this was first, but Ignition Remix, which isn't really rap, either, whatever, but Ignition Remix came out and that was like, whoa, this is the end of history. And so those two songs kind of defined in many ways my college experience, but like, you know, Hey Ma is a good example. Like, the lyrics of that I love now, but back then I would kind of like mumble them. I didn't know even what they were. I just knew it was an amazing beat. So I was getting into rap and getting into lyricism, and my friends, particularly my co-founders, but also my other friends and early people on the site, were explaining it to me, and they were explaining it in a very specific way. There'd be a line that would happen, maybe a Cam'ron line, and they'd pause the track, and they'd say, listen to that, you hear that line, what that means, or what that's referring to, or that's actually a subliminal reference to this thing, like, let me explain this now, let's go back and play it again. And so we were having these conversations, I was just blown away. I was like, wow, there's so much going on here that I had no idea about. This is amazing. And this, of course, was a beautiful time in rap. Like, this is 2009. This was when Lil Wayne was just, like, murdering everyone. And, you know, Cam'ron was more current than he is now. And, you know, it was a beautiful time for rap, and it was a beautiful time for me to get into it. And so we would be having these conversations. And then, you know, we had the idea to take these conversations and just try to, like, put them on the internet, like, create a site where someone could experience what I was experiencing in real time without having to have access to the people who were my friends. And so, you know, the original version of the site was called Rap Exegesis. You can actually look at the original version of the site. This was part of this.
I love that you kept it up. It's rapgenius-genesis.heroku.com?
Yes, that's right. Yes, that is the original version of the site. That it took me from 12:30 to 6:30 on August 26th, I believe, 2009, to create this, and it went out. And that was the first version, and it's pretty much what the site is today, honestly. Like, it's not so different today.
And so, were you thinking about size of market, revenue, any of that stuff when you built these businesses?
Well, for Bomb Sheets, I kind of was. We kind of were.
Like, but not for Rap Genius. Not for
Bomb Sheets. Was inspired by sort of, at the time I read the 4-Hour Work Week, and I thought the 4-Hour Work Week, this is inspirational. Like, this, you know, now some aspects seem corny, but some aspects are cool, which is like, I really want to build, like, not a big business with VC, whatever. I just want to build something to make some money. And then with Rap Genius, I wasn't even thinking that. We were thinking, like, let's just do this cool art project. And, you know, I thought it was cool because I thought the technology of clicking the line and seeing what was going on in the line, you know, what it meant, but also, like, why it was cool. And then also that combined with the writers that we had access to, which was, like, my friends and, you know, a group of people, like 10, 15 people who were all really good writers. And I was like, this technology, simple but cool, plus these writers, we can create this really cool art project. And that's how I kind of saw it. I saw it as this art project, and that's what it was for a long time.
You know, I was telling Tim Ferriss the other day that he might be the most quoted person or the most referred to person in Mixergy interviews. And I asked him if he could talk about that part of this process. What is it about his ideas that somehow just touched you and so many other entrepreneurs? We'll see if we can do that in the future. The top of the interview, I said that it took you less than 6 hours. And I later corrected and said that it's basically less than 6 hours because of the work that you did previously. What were you able to use so that you can launch within 6 hours?
Right, so this is like how, you know, you can't connect the dots going forward or whatever, which is that, like, on Better Metro North, there was this interface where you could type in using, like, natural language the date for the train you wanted to get. So you could say, show me trains on, you know, a week from next Tuesday or whatever, mm-hmm. and that would work. And that I thought was really cool, even though, you know, when people use the site, it's usually, like, the button for today or the button for tomorrow is what they click, rather than, like, clicking the third option and typing some complicated thing. But I thought it was cool. So I did that, and then I created a little help thing that allowed you to understand how this interface worked. And so you click the little help button, and this little tooltip would appear showing you, you know, here's an example of what you can type and so forth. And when I was thinking about Rap Genius and, like, how can I, you know, represent the idea on the screen of, like, giving context to a piece of line, I was like, you know, that tooltip library I looked at, which is called Q-tip, and it's still on the internet. You can look it up right now. It's like, that tooltip library was actually pretty, like, pretty functional. Like, you know, maybe I could repurpose it for a task that it was not originally intended. And, you know, tooltip is to provide contextual help for how to use an interface or something. But I think it's actually a pretty full feature library. Maybe I could repurpose that to actually show these annotations. And so I, you know, the original Rap Genius thing, I copy and pasted the Better Metro North code. So it is literally the code. And I just took that library and reconfigured it and added, you know, added a little bit of subtlety to the way it was integrated. And that became the central interface, or excuse me, the central UI paradigm of Rap Genius, which can persist today. And it's not perfect, by the way, but it's good enough, which is you click the line, a little bubble appears next to it. And so, you know, it's gone through some iterations, but we're still using the Q-tip library today, you know, 5 years, 4 years.
The same one now, even though I think you even show images within those tips.
Right, so the Q-tip can contain any type of, it can contain any HTML. And so, yeah, we have images in there, obviously, like, getting all that to work and the editing interface and everything was complicated, but the actual bubble that shows you an annotation is still that same Q-tip library, same damn low sweater.
You know, I love the piece that First Round did on you, the case study about how you built up Rap Genius and how you were willing to launch without getting it perfect. I'm trying to square that with what you told us earlier about getting the right level of quality at D.E. Shaw. Mm-hmm. I'd imagine that someone with your background and who worked for a company with such attention to detail would have a wrestling match internally with releasing something that wasn't right.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And, you know, so the philosophy in the First Round thing and the main thing about that speech was worse is better, which is basically this idea that the worst thing you can imagine is the best thing. And so, you know, the fun exercise in the speech is I say, everyone yell out the worst thing you can imagine, and that's the best thing, and everyone yells. But the idea is, purposefully, when you're trying to put a product out there, a new thing, release the worst version you can think of and try to make it bad and get it out there. And the assumption underlying this is that that is subverting your normal impulse. And so, yes, my normal impulse, which is, you know, somewhat innate and somewhat taught to me by D. Shaw and other places, is make it perfect. Is details matter in software. Like, details matter in interfaces is the normal impulse. And so the idea of worse is better is subvert that impulse and release something that sucks, and a bunch of people are going to tell you that it sucks, and you're going to know they're right, and it's still the right thing to do. So that's the challenge, which is, you know, it is very, very much against my impulses, and I still get caught in a better is better trap a lot of times. Like, oh, I got to perfect it before I get it out there. I still get caught in that, and that's like a piece of, vernacular here at Rap Genius. Like, someone will propose something, and then someone else will say, well, that's a little bit better is better. Which is kind of like saying, look, I get it, that's better, that's more detail-oriented, but it's not the worst is better philosophy, and, you know, it's not going to be good. And, you know, there, I can get into, like, why I think the worst is better philosophy is
why.
It's
and
good.
Then I want to ask you a question about an issue that I've had with that same philosophy, because I believe in that, but why? You were going to say that there's a reason why that makes sense.
Yeah, so there are a couple of different reasons. So the big reason, or the first reason I always think of, is that bad ideas evolve into good ideas in ways that you wouldn't anticipate. Like, you can't, the best way to have a good idea is to have a bad idea and watch it evolve. And so, you know, when you're thinking of, you know, some kind of, like, finished product or finished idea, you know, or rather when you're putting yourself out there with a bad idea, you're thinking, like, this is the thing I'm putting out there. But really, that's version one. You'll put it out there and you'll look at it and then you'll have other ideas. So you have to trust yourself that you'll be able to have other ideas that will evolve that bad idea into something good. And so, you know, that's one core idea. And a related idea, the second core idea, is that bad ideas evolve into good ideas, but they evolve into good ideas with the data you get from having it out there. So you don't know what the perfect idea, you shouldn't shoot for perfection because you don't know what perfection is before you start. You have to build something, you have to see how people will react, and you know the sort of thought experiment I use to think about this is like, you are the dumbest you'll ever be right now. Like you're only going to get smarter, you're only going to get more data. So make as few decisions as you can now while you're dumb, and postpone them to when you're smart. And here's a really good example of this. In the original version of Rap Genius, there was this concept of confidence, which was an attribute on an annotation. So you could say, you can add an annotation, and you could say, I have confidence level high. And what this was supposed to mean was that I'm confident in this annotation. Or you could add confidence level low, which means like, I think it's what this line is about, but I'm not sure. And that was something that I thought was going to be important, but it actually was totally irrelevant. Like, it was totally useless and irrelevant. Like, there were a lot of things I had to change from the first version of Rap Genius to get to where we are today. And there's a lot of things we have to change in the future, but adding that confidence attribute, at least so far, has not been the most important thing. And yet, when I was sitting in the dark on my own programming, I thought it was important. But once the design reached the light of day and people started using it, I realized other things were important.
What was more important than confidence?
Well, for one thing, what was more important was giving people the ability to easily add annotations, like giving a way to sign up, a way for you to add an annotation to a page that I was also editing without us, you know, clobbering one another. One really important thing was giving people points for adding annotations was a pretty important thing. And then the final principle is that if you set yourself a standard for perfection when you launch a product, you'll never be able to get yourself to put yourself out there at all, because you'll always be thinking like, ah, this isn't perfect, like it needs to be better. You know, like, you know, if you hold yourself to such a high standard, you'll be too intimidated by like your anxiety of influence, by like all the great things that have happened before you, and like how can I put this out there at all if it's not perfect? You'll never be able to release things. And it's actually even more insidious, because you will be able to release some things, but the things you'll be able to release are small features, small improvements. And that's a big problem. And this is, again, like sort of at my core of like what I think is important, what I think is unimportant, which is that, you know, my attention to detail is such that like, I really want to release features every day that are going to smooth over small UI issues on Rap Genius. That's just going to make it easier. Like, you know, you can hit shift and enter to like save an annotation as a shortcut key, or, you know, make it easier to add an image here or there, or whatever. And these things are good, but ultimately you need to think big. You need to think about big features that you're going to release that are going to change the game. And so, you know, my test is like, can we as a company IPO without this feature? And if the answer is yes, work on something bigger. And so if you hold yourself to a standard of perfection, you will release only things that you can make perfect, which will be very small things.
Wait, so you're saying do only create things that could eventually lead you to IPO?
I'm saying don't work on anything that's not big enough, or excuse me, only work on things that you need to IPO.
Whatever. When you do, create them in a small enough way that it's a bad first version.
Right, just do a bad first version of a really big important thing and then try to improve it once it's out.
Gotcha. What about this though, Tom, that I found that when I do that, often I neglect things and don't improve them. Like if I didn't have this philosophy, maybe it would have taken me longer to launch interviews and I would have tried to get the video perfect and everything right, but at least I would have been on my path to improving the quality of the video. Today, I launched it, it feels like it's good enough. People can hear you, they can hear me. And I've left it, and I'm not thinking about how do I improve it. And so the question I have here is, does this culture of just launch it and then move on, or launch it and be okay with it, lead to stagnation?
I think that's a really good question. I mean, I think there are two sides to this. One is that what is good enough, right? So you re-release your video thing, your video platform, and it works to a certain degree, and maybe it's not the most elegant, streamlined thing that you would like, but it works, and then, you know, now you're working on other stuff. And the question is what you're working on more or less important than improving the video thing? And you know, it seems like you're voting with your feet and saying, well, this is good enough, and there's this other high priority stuff I should do. So, you know, the other answer is that good enough is often, like, better than you might think in the abstract, especially from a prioritization perspective. Like, you have limited time on Earth. Like, what do you actually want to do?
So how do you get feedback so that you know what needs to get fixed?
But let me say the second part of that is I think getting caught in the worst state is a legit risk. I think that's something that's happened a bunch in my life. Like
give me an example of you launching something that was the worst possible and you got stuck in the worst state as a result of it.
What's a good example? One example is the support on the site for other types of text, right? Like beyond songs. So we released this thing where you could put anything up, you know, poems, books, movie scripts, etc. And for a while, it was just the exact same technology. So you'd have the Great Gatsby, and the Great Gatsby Chapter 1 would be on an album, and that album we called the Great Gatsby, and all the chapters would be tracks on that album, and it's like, okay, that's pretty bad. And so we made a lot of improvements to that, and we changed it. I mean, now, for example, it doesn't say Great Gatsby Chapter 1 lyrics anywhere, which was, you know, a problem. But I don't think we've gone far enough in terms of supporting, you know, other texts yet. And this is something we're working on now. And, you know, I wouldn't say necessarily we got caught in worse is better. But we, you know, we didn't give
it. So how do you prioritize, Tom, with all these different things that you could do? You could improve the way that people annotate rap lyrics. You can expand beyond rap and go to more depth. You can get more traffic. You can do books. You can do video, which is a vision of yours to allow people to annotate even this conversation. How do you figure out what's going to be most important?
That is the question. You know, product strategy, what do we build? You know, that is the question. Not like how does it look, you know, or how does it behave, or what's the interface? Like, what do we build is the question. I think, you know, that gets at like the core of you know, what it means to like run a business. I mean, I think the key sort of meta point when you're thinking about it is you need to be very picky. You need to have focus. And that's something that, like, once you are in the position that Rap Genius is in today, focus is very hard because there's so many things that we could do. Like you mentioned annotating videos, annotating images. There are a bunch of people on the site right now who are saying, image annotation is the future. Obviously, you draw a little lasso tool around the Mona Lisa's eyebrows or lack thereof or whatever, and you annotate, what's the deal with Mona Lisa not having, or her smile, or, you know, or my, you know, pick a picture of me and draw a thing around my Nikes or whatever. And so that's one thing we could do. That could be big. You know, there's a bunch of other stuff, the video thing, et cetera. So you need to have focus and you need to say, okay, we can't do all this stuff. Let's pick one thing and push towards it. And, you know, with Rap Genius, like, I think the strategy is interesting because, you know, we have this rap community, this rap portion of this of the site, of the experience that is extremely strong. And something that we have to like push forward and like make sure it stays strong, but also make sure we innovate and make sure we think, okay, now that we have a community of hundreds of active moderators and thousands of contributors, like how do we keep that community strong? And how do we help think about like once the other communities grow up, what lessons does this original community teach us about how to manage big communities of annotators? So that's definitely a priority for us, is like making sure that Rap Genius not only stays strong, but also puts us in a position.
Do you have a framework for figuring out what's next? Do you go for video or images? Do you have a way of doing that? Or is it just which of those two is most likely to get us to the big IPO and that's the one we're going to go for?
Well, the broad framework is to like think about improving and preserving and learning from what we have in rap and music, and then take other things, probably one other thing, and concentrate on it really hardcore, whether it's image annotation, video annotation, the annotation of literature, the annotation of news primary source documents, and then within that, the way we think about priorities is we want to optimize for the people, the hardcore contributors, the hardcore community members. So like, you know, 80%, like there's the 80-20 rule in like UGC sites, and we actually did the math on this recently, and it's actually literally exactly true for Rap Genius, which was shocking.
What is it, 20% are?
20% of the users, the most active, dedicated, engaged, 20% of the users create 80% of the content. Gotcha. And so when we think about product strategy, we think about those 20% of users all exclusively. And this means that going to Rap Genius as one of the other 80% of users who's not the core, they get not the best experience. Like they go and they think, huh, like, you know, this site's janky in some ways and maybe not the slickest thing. And, you know, this annotation technology, when I click on the little thing and the thing appears, that looks pretty similar to the first version of the site. So like, what have you been working on? But then they also notice, God, these annotations are pretty good. And so what makes the annotations good is building stuff around and encouraging and helping the community that writes them, and that's what we focus on, because the quality of the analysis, the quality of the annotations is the most important thing, not like the presentation and how slick they look when you read them.
I'm on the site right now, the version that you created and put up on Heroku. It's got one song.
Not even
You're
a full
starting
song.
That small.
Not even a full song. It's three couplets.
Yeah. Yeah, three couplets. And so that was your experiment, and then you bought rapgenius.com?
Well, we actually stayed rapexegesis for about 5 months, which is just, that tells you how dumb we were back then, because rapexegesis is a pretty bad name. And then one of one of the founding editors of the site, also my roommate at the time, Ariel Schneller, big ups to Ariel, he threatened to just delete all his annotations and stop working on the site unless we changed the name, because he was like, this is totally ridiculous. So we changed it to Rap Genius about 4 or 5 months later.
Okay.
And that was a good move.
Your first users were your friends. You were emailing them. How do you go beyond your friends to get people into a community that basically will suck unless people annotate?
Yeah,
unless people put in the work.
The most important thing when you're thinking about a community like this is you want to set the tone yourself, because when someone comes to the site, they're going to look at it and they're going to say, okay, I can get a sense for what's going on the site. Are the people who are annotating here, the people who are contributing here, are they like me or are they not like me? In other words, like, do they think about music in the way I think about it? Do they take this like seriously? Are they really interested in going deep? Or are they just trying to make like a superficial joke and like, you know, not, you know.
Got it. Right. So, if they're not taking it as seriously as I am, then I feel like a douche if I take it seriously and I better get away.
Right, and so that was the early stages were us, and we didn't know we were doing this. We just thought we were doing a good job because that's what we want to do. But we were really setting the tone with like a high standard of quality, and you know, in both the content and the writing.
Why? I understand why you would do it, Tom. This is your baby. It's your passion. But your friends who didn't get a share in the business, who weren't as invested, why do they care enough to post annotations onto rap lyrics?
Well, it was cool, you know. I mean, it was.
What did you do to make it cool enough that they would do that, as opposed to go on Reddit and comment, or watch a movie on Netflix, or do any of the billion, jillion different things that they could do online?
Well, I mean, you know, it wasn't so different from like, you know, in college, like we all had Blogspot blogs, like, you know, so putting stuff online and talking about it and letting it stand. So like, you know, one example is Ariel. Ariel, who you know, user ID2, threatened to you know, kill me if I didn't change the name. You know, he wrote this epic blog post in like 2008, where he basically did a huge analysis of like current sort of trends in rap and concluded that the Clips was the best group ever. And like that was this huge blog post he did, and you know, Rap Genius was just a better format for that. Like he was writing it anyway on some, you know, on his WordPress blog. And so it was just a cool way of presenting things. It was also this group project where we could get together and kind of, you know, argue about stuff and then come together and produce something that was like, you know, not only like greater than the sum of our individual contributions, but looked like it was written by, like we used to say, like the voice of God. Like you can't tell who's writing this, but there's a ton of great content and how to do it.
So did you said that one of the things you discovered later on was the importance of points. Did you do anything to give people points or status early on when it was just a handful of people creating the culture of the site? What did you do? You're nodding.
We had a leaderboard in the earliest days, which was just the number of annotations you created.
Got it.
It's not a bad proxy. Not a bad proxy. Then it got way more sophisticated and complicated. And that was also after we opened it up. So like in the early days, it was just, you know, you'd have to talk to me to get an account. And you know, so it was just our friends, and then we put these discus comments at the bottom. We just dropped in that little JavaScript thing, and then people started leaving comments. People started saying, no, you're wrong about this. This is the right thing. And I was like, oh, that's cool. And so we'd sort of invite some of those people in, and then we'd have like, you know, maybe 10 or 15 of our friends, and then maybe 10 or 15 people I had never met but were interested. We did that for a while, and then we decided, you know what, let's just open it up entirely. Let anyone sign up and start annotating. And that was like the real, like, that was a true engineering, like, effort to, like, really allow for that, because, you know, someone could just go crazy and delete the whole site. So you have to, like, prepare for that. And that also corresponded with the creation of the original Rap IQ system, which was based on number of annotations, but also there was a whole editorial workflow where if you were a new user and you posted an annotation, I, as an editor, would have to accept it before it would be visible to other people. And so you're getting your annotation accepted, gave you points, and I also got a couple of points, but less, but fewer for being a moderator, and so then it got very complicated, and then, you know, people started gaming it, and this whole headache, but still the same fundamental idea.
That group of users who was coming in after you and your friends, where did you find them? How did they find you?
It's a mix, you know. I mean, Google search was a great user acquisition channel, so to speak. You know, I still don't know really how you build a website that and get people to use it. Like, Google search is kind of like a cheat code in some ways for that. Like, you know, if you think about it, like, it's pretty weird that someone can type what they want into Google and end up on your site without even knowing you exist. Like, that's pretty magical. So Google was one thing, but, you know, the thing about something like Rap Genius is it's not like, you know, it's not like Twitter where you need millions and millions of users to create a great thing. It's more like Wikipedia. Like, you don't need, like, one amazing contributor can create, you know, a canonical version of a song that'll last a decade, and millions of people will see it. So, you know, it's also very, like, hit and miss. So, for example, one of our greatest early contributors, one of the only members of the 200 Club, which is having 200,000 plus total IQ, is a gentleman, Sean Sitaro, who we found, who found us in the early days because he read about us in New York Magazine. And so, you know, my opinion on press is that it's not really that useful generally. But in this case, this is, and now he works here full time, and he's a crucial part of the voice of the site and the thinking of the future of the site. And, you know, if we had never gotten that New York Magazine approval matrix thing, he would have never found us. That ended up being like a very pivotal connection early
that
on.
That New York Magazine approval matrix, that was the somewhat brilliant and highbrow, that's what they called you. You were hoping that you were going to get traffic from it. You got no traffic from it, right?
Right.
No.
Right, nothing.
Nothing, except you met Sean as a result of it.
Yes.
Got it. So 2010 was the year that you were describing earlier where things were going nowhere. The trough of sorrow, I think they call it, a Y Combinator.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think you know, we launched in you know, September, October 2009, and then 2010 was not great. I mean, at the end we started to see some glimmers of hope, but 2010 was toiling in obscurity, definitely.
So then, why did you stick with it?
Was when we released the thing that allowed anyone to sign up and contribute, and that ended up being like a big change. But before that, it was pretty bad.
I'm looking at the version of the site that was up on 2010. Rap Genius explains rap lyrics. Click a song to reveal its meaning. There are like 10 songs on the site. And you limited this 10 songs on the homepage, and you seem to have limited the number of songs to maybe 100. Was that intentional? To keep it focused on a handful before you allow people to annotate any song?
Well, at that point, we had this idea of publishing a song, where we would not release the song publicly and show people that it was on the site until it was done or until it was at a certain level of quality. And this goes back to like the setting the tone thing, which we didn't really know what we were doing, but like, just the site didn't have a ton of stuff, but all the stuff it did have was really good, and that's way better than having a ton of stuff that's mediocre. Now we have a little bit of a different philosophy, which is just, you know, we have enough good stuff that, and people understand the way it works, that like, if you stumble upon something that's bad, there's a ton of bad stuff, like, you're more likely to say like, oh, wait, this is some bad progress thing, I'm going to help make this better, rather than say like, okay, this reveals that the people involved in the site actually don't care about it. Quality, which is what you have to worry about in the early days.
Did you get permission to use the lyrics on the site back in 2010?
Great question. No, you know, we just did it. You know, we believed then, and I believe now, that it's fair use to sort of adding all this commentary and criticism and so forth is transformative, but obviously there's a legal sort of risk that you take when you do something like this. And, you know, my philosophy on it is, especially, you know, if you think you're being like a good actor, like, if you really can look yourself in the mirror and say like, are you jacking from someone or are you creating something new? And you can look in the mirror and say like, I'm not trying to just take someone else's thing. I'm really trying to create a new thing that uses some ingredients. Then I think, you know, you got to go for it, because,
so even today it's considered transformative, and so you don't need permission.
Well, I think it's transformative, you know, and
do you pay licensing fees?
Well, someday maybe the transformative thing will come to the fore. That will be like our position. But for now, you know, primarily because we're not trying to like create some, you know, it'd be cool to like go to the Supreme Court and win or whatever. But like, that's not what I think is a good use of like our time. So right now we do have licensing agreements with most of the music publishers, and, you know, hopefully all of them soon. And, you know, the other thing is, you want to work with the music publishers. Like, I, you know, I think that, like, you know, there's a lot of, like, stuff that we can, like, do together. Like, obviously, like, the verified artist stuff on Rap Genius, like, making it just a part of, you know, promoting yourself as an artist and getting in deep in the music industry is, like, a big part of, like, what we want to do. So, you know, it's also, you know, good to just play nice for that reason as well. And, you know, they're cool guys, so.
That seems like the common way that many lyric sites that are big today started, by just grabbing lyrics, putting it on their site. And in fact, one entrepreneur told me that the companies that records, actually used to send him stuff to give to fans to promote the fact that the new album was coming out, and so they knew that what he was doing, and then they later on made a deal with him. Why did you stick with it during 2010 when there wasn't money coming in, when you were saying that this is the tough period? What made you stick it out?
That's a good question. I mean, there are two things, I think. One is that it wasn't, in our minds, it wasn't a business. It was an art project. And once it's a business, you have to think, is this a successful business? But if it's an art project, all you have to think is this a successful art project? And the criteria for being a successful art project is way simpler. It's like, do I think it's cool? Do my friends think it's cool? You know, is this something unique? Is this something no one else is doing? It's a way easier criteria than is this, like, making money or, you know, generating investment interest. So that was one thing. But even that is tough, because there is the opportunity cost of your time. And I'm thinking, like, you know, got it, you know, if this doesn't go well, I'm going to have to get another job. Like, I don't want another job. But, you know, the other thing was that it did get people liked it. Like, you know, got in the New York Magazine. Like, in, you know, I remember the day. The day that I mentioned earlier, where Alon and I were at lunch, and I was kind of like, Rap Genius is done from a technical perspective. Like, we shouldn't work on it anymore. We went back to the apartment, and Andy Volodkin, the Hype Machine founder, had just tweeted, like, this is a cool website. The design's kind of janky, or something like that. And I saw that, and we were just like, whoa, that is the coolest thing. Like, we love Hype Machine. Like, this is great. And so, like, enough stuff like that happened where we were, like, not thinking necessarily, like, this is going to be a business, or this is going to be something that we can use to, like, raise money and eventually create a business, but that this is, like, a cool thing that should be in the world and should be better and improved. And so, yeah, that's kind of, like, what kept us going.
I want to ask you something that could come off as a little jerky, but I think it's important to ask you. But first, let me do a quick plug here for Scott Edward Walker. He is the entrepreneur's lawyer. If you're a startup, if you're running a startup, you need a lawyer who understands the issues you're coming up against and won't look down on you. I had a lawyer once who I got a lawsuit from a major bank. He saw the lawsuit and he started to freak out, and then he freaked me out. And I realized, this guy just doesn't get my world. He's freaking me out. I had to relax and realize that these companies seem to send out lawsuits like it's nothing. They sent, like, this binder like that. And when I started looking at the binder for the lawsuit, I realized they included, like, every brochure they came up with, every document that they ever printed, to show that they were so significant that I could potentially damage what they were doing. Anyway, a lawyer who doesn't deal with entrepreneurs is going to freak out so much more than one who gets the entrepreneurs the entrepreneurship community of pushing limits, of seeing what's okay, and he'll understand to be there to support you. He'll understand that you need to prepare for things that most companies won't go through, raising money, selling out, dealing with co-founders, etc. If you need a lawyer like that and you don't want one who's going to make you pay through the nose, I recommend you talk to Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. Send him an email right now. Here's his email address. Scott@walkercorporatelaw.com. Tom, the question is, why did you need co-founders? You seem to be doing well. You're a smart guy.
No, it's a good question, you know, and I think it's interesting. A couple things. Like, I think once you've got, like, it's kind of a silly question for me, like, looking back on, like, everything that has happened, it's like, it is impossible to do something like this alone. And, you know, when I mean like this, I actually think it's even broader. Like, I think anything big, anything worthwhile you want to do, forget business, any project that you want to do that's big and worthwhile, you just can't do it alone. There's just too much, and it's too hard if it is new. So that's, like, the broad thing, which is something I've come to believe, not just about business, but about everything. So, like, if I were to, you know, start writing a book or whatever, like, you can't do that alone either. Now, in this particular case, you know, the importance of co-founders is, like, if you zoom in, like, two things. Like, one is just, if you're staring into the void, and you're doing it alone, like, you can't stare into the void alone. Like, when you're truly, truly staring into the void.
Give me an example. When did you stare into the void when Mabod, or, am I pronouncing his name right? Mabod?
It's tough. Mahbod.
Oh, he's Mahbod.
He's my boo on the site. He went by Matt in high school.
No, I want to get the right name. Tell me if I'm pronouncing it right. Mahbod.
Mahbod.
Mahbod. And Ilan.
So, you know, in the beginning, staring into the void, like, you know, okay, like, there's no content on the site. Like, what are we going to do? How are we going to get the content? Okay, no one is going to the site. Like,
so which of them helped you stop staring into the void and fill the void?
So Mahbod was, in addition to being one of the most prolific people in terms of raw content creation early on, was one of the people who was, he was just amazing at, like, building communities. And, you know, what this means in practice is talking to a bunch of people on the internet and inspiring them to, you know, join our mission of love and knowledge. And, you know, I just, like, I don't know, one individual case, there was someone who, like, hit us up and was just, like, so mean. It was like, you know, you guys are, like, the worst, you know, and this whole project is terrible and I hate you guys. And my reaction to it was I was kind of like, all right, forget this, like, archive, like, I don't want to think about this, like, whatever. And Mockwood was like, yo, you're 100% right, but think about this, too, and blah, blah, blah. And then, like, that guy, like, is now, like a close friend. Like, Mockwood is just so good at, like, turning people from...
That guy's a close friend.
Yeah.
Okay, wow. By the way, I believe in... I don't always have the... Actually, I think I do often have the patience for that, but I believe in taking those, what people would call trolls... and hugging them, really embracing them, because if they're so passionate that they're saying things like that, then you want to hear what their passion is and hopefully have them work with you.
Truly, big ups to all my haters. You know, I mean, I think Mahbod, you know, has taught me so much about, like, that kind of stuff. It's great. And just, you know, not even just the haters, just, like, taking someone who's kind of into the site and saying, like, you know, let me inspire you in a ton of different ways. And also Mahbod... is a brilliant, like, writer and just wordsmith. And, you know, if you go to his account, rapgenius.com/Mabu, you will see a...
do it right now.
Just a ton of amazing writing. And Ilan, you know, Ilan was, like, my, like, first real, like, true, like, business collaborator. Like, we started way before Rap Genius when we first moved in together. And, like, you know, Mahbod got involved with the Rap Genius project at the very beginning, but Ilan and I had been collaborating before that, and, you know, Ilan and I just have a pretty unique, like, back and forth in terms of, like, how we, like, sort of run things or make things happen, you know, like, there's one sense in a very literal sense, which is, like, I did do the programming, and Ilan raises the money, but it's not really like that. It's, like, everything in terms of, like, really running the thing, we're, like, bouncing it off, and, like, I have a somewhat harsher personality in terms of, like, how I want to deal with things, and he has somewhat of a more, like, chill personality, and just us fighting that out, you know, produces great, like, results. And, like, Ilan also is, like, I was actually thinking the other day, I was with my friend Ariel, who was user ID 2, and we were talking about Ilan, and we were just thinking, God, Ilan is just so likable. Like, we were challenging ourselves. We were like, name one person who doesn't like Ilan or that Ilan doesn't like. And we were like, I can't name it. He is, like, just such, like, and the reason for that is because when you are talking to Ilan, he is just zoned in on you, and he's genuine. It's not like a trick. He is genuinely deeply interested in who you are and what you have to say, and that makes Ilan just crucially, brilliantly invaluable in a bunch of different situations, whether it's, like, a management situation, like the psychology of managing people who work for you, like, listening to feelings, hearing them out, understanding, like, where they're coming for, or whether it's raising money and talking to an investor and really, really, you know, connecting on a real level and understanding where that person's coming from.
So let me ask you one other jerky question as a follow-up to the first one.
Sure.
You still own more shares in the company or bigger share of the company than they do, right?
I don't know where you got that idea.
So is it equally divided?
You know, I mean... The key thing to think about is, like, all of us are on the board, you know, and so the real question about, like, who runs the actual thing, like, you know, there's a question of, like, you know, who is operationally responsible on a day-to-day basis for making this or that final call, but then there's the question of, like, the deep direction of the company, like, who is actually in that position to make the final call, and, you know, that is what the board is for, and so all of us are involved in that and participating in terms of, like, the real big direction of the company. Now, on a day-to-day basis, like, you know, we have different responsibilities, et cetera. You know, I mean, the thing about, like, setting up a company is that, you know, the way things come together, the good thing we did at the beginning of Rap Genius was we didn't sit down on day one and think, okay, this is a company, we're going to appoint officers to the company, and we are going to split up equity in the company. And you have to do that eventually, but you don't want to do that when you're sort of splitting up percentages of zero. And this is something I'm, you know, glad we, you know, delayed in Rap Genius. Like, earlier in my life, I was the sort of entrepreneur who shows up to discuss an idea with someone who's, you know, new to the idea, and I want to bring, like, an NDA. Like, that literally happened to me, like the meme thing, like the first, or Fliff, the first idea was Alon and me, and we were going to talk to my work friend, and, you know, friend, Peyton, and we were going to go to him and say, you know, Peyton, what do you think of this idea? You want to work with us on this, but sign this NDA. And Peyton was like, what are you, get this, are you an idiot? Like, we're not going to do an NDA, we're not going to set up a company, we're not going to do anything. Like, let's build the thing, and then see what happens. And, you know,
so this decision didn't happen until you raised money, it sounds like.
Until we got into Y Combinator.
Y Combinator. That was a huge deal for you guys. Why do you think Y Combinator funded you?
Whew, that's a good question. You know, we did. First of all, we got rejected from Y Combinator the first time. We applied twice in a row, and then we got rejected the first time. So you can get rejected, and then the next time you can apply and get in and be one of the hottest startups in Y Combinator. So world's a crazy place. Why did Y Combinator fund us? I think there are two reasons. One, objectively speaking, we were an attractive thing. We had a graph that was looking really nice. It was going up. We had passed 1 million unique visitors, which is a hard thing to do as a website that you just created, and the graph was looking good. And so we were a legit, like, good prospect. Also, there's a guy called Justin Kahn who denies it to this day, but I really think he hooked us up because we he wrote this blog post where he was like, you know, the connection between entrepreneurship and rap music, and, you know, he wrote this blog post, and then he linked to us for the he quoted various rap songs, and he linked to Rap Genius, and we saw this, and we were like, wow, this is sick, like, Justin Kahn, he's a huge meme. And so Mopboat, of course, being down to, like, talk to anyone in the world, like, hit him up on Facebook chat, we were chatting with him for a while, and, you know, Justin Kahn was like, you know, we were like, well, we were a finalist in Techstar, should we take that if we get in? And Justin Kahn was like, yeah, probably, but, like, you want to do Y Combinator if you can. And, like, we were kind of like, well, we got rejected. Should we apply again? He was like, yeah, you got a great website. It's a growing website. You should apply. And so, you know, that encouraged us to apply, which we might not have even done. And, you know, that year I also, before we applied, I hitched a ride with my friend Rich, who was going to South by Southwest for his company. And I stayed on his couch. First time I ever used Airbnb. And then I stalked Justin Kahn after, like, some talk. And I stalked him to the Starbucks where he was meeting with someone, and then when he got up and left, I, like, bumped into him. I was like, oh, Justin Kahn, what's up? And then we, like, talked for a while that day, and I followed him around a little bit, and we talked, and, you know, I think, you know, I don't know if he put in a good word for us or something, but, like, that was, like, a good, like, connection to the Y Combinator family, and, like, you know, sort of talking to him and getting his perspective really helped, and, you know, also just encouraging us to apply. You know, we might not have even applied.
Yeah, after being rejected twice, I could understand why you wouldn't.
Once, but it was, you know, when we were rejected, it was like, well, obviously we were rejected. It's some crazy rap lyric annotation website. And then that's the reality you form in your head. You know, of course we're not going to get accepted. It's a totally ridiculous idea.
Why didn't you accept that? Was it because Techstars started to see some promise here, and so you thought, all right, maybe? Or was it just that the numbers were starting to go up?
It's crazy. I mean, we got into Y Combinator, and we just were so, like, intimidated by everyone who was there, and, you know, it was just this trippy thing, because, like, before Y Combinator, no one cared. Like, no one cared. I was kind of down with that. I was kind of like, okay, no one cares, like, whatever, I'm used to that. And then after Y Combinator, when we had Demo Day and after, everyone cared. Like, we were one of the hottest startups in that Y Combinator bash, and because of that, had a solid claim on being one of the hottest startups in the entire world at that time in history. Everyone cared, everyone was into it, and it was 3 months had passed, and to my eyes, nothing had changed. It was like the same website. We had grown a lot in Y Combinator, but the graph looked good before. Like, you could have probably predicted some of that growth by looking at the graph, and the site was basically the same. The site improved a little bit. It was only 3 months, and we went, you know, from no one caring to everyone caring in such a short amount of time, and that, like, kind of convinced me, like, whoa, like, the world's a weird place. Like, I don't know what's going on, you know? Like, you got to believe. You just got to believe in yourself. It's corny. Oh, wow. It's true.
And so the business didn't change much through the 3 months. You grew as people, but it wasn't externally visible yet.
We grew a lot in traffic, is really the truth. And Y Combinator, that was one of the fastest times of growth ever. Watch the Throne came out. That was a big thing for us. And we, you know, almost tripled in size during Y Combinator, which is a lot of growth.
Let's Watch the Throne. I should know that, but I don't.
Watch the Throne is Jay-Z, Kanye West, a joint project, summer 2011. Great album.
Okay. You then got, was it BetaWorks that came in as an investor right afterwards?
Yeah, I guess you're probably reading that on Crunchbase.
Yeah, Crunchbase. I don't know that this is actually. Yeah, BetaWorks the next one?
Yeah, we did Seed Round after Y Combinator, and it was actually about like 16 or 17 or 18 different investors, including BetaWorks, and you know, we were hot and had interest, but it still was hard to raise money. It still took us a long time. You know, you read these stories about, oh, you Y Combinator demo day, and you leave demo day, and you got a bunch of signed whatevers, and you're good at demo day. Like, not how it worked for us. Maybe it happens to some people like that. And so we, you know, we raised about $1.8 million, but when we were raising, it seemed like we were going to be able to raise $400K, and how are we going to get more than this? Like, we're screwed. So it was a hard process, but we ended up doing it and raised a nice round, and, you know, that lasted us for a little bit, and then we started fundraising almost immediately again, because $1.8 million seems like a lot, but it actually doesn't get you that far. And then when we, you know, the second round of fundraising was a longer, different process, and that, you know, landed us with the $15 million from Ben Horowitz was, you know, that was a nice little...
That's when the world, I felt, the startup world said, whoa.
Yeah.
Right? Lyrics this big. What did you say to them? What did you show them that made them sign on?
Well, one thing we said was, okay, so you think this is totally ridiculous. Well, okay, we're going to go on stage in sunglasses and, like, troll you even more. And that was a bad idea because people don't really, like, totally get the joke. So, you know, we did, like, TechCrunch Disrupt, which is, like, this video that shows up in the comment sections of any article or Hacker News discussion about us with probability one. It's kind of like a Rap Genius Godwin's Law thing. It's like, look at these fucking douches with the sunglasses. It's a joke, but it was dumb. But, yeah, I mean, it's tricky because what you want to say is, like, look, you know, there's this whole future world. We didn't get the money to do rap lyrics. We didn't get the money to do lyrics in general. We got the money for this broader idea of guiding you through and annotating and breaking down human culture. And, you know, we started with rap lyrics. It's very, very hard. If you were saying, okay, you know, build a website that all it does, it's not that good. All it does is give you the best meaning and most interesting facts about every line in the history of rap. Like, that's all you have to do. That's very hard to do in of itself. But, like, taking the sort of strengths and the software and the ideas that help us build that and applying it to other places where what people were thinking. And so, in some sense, you tell people about that. But in another sense, it's like, you know, whatever. Like, the work should stand for itself. So I'm not trying to tell people, like, we're going to do all this great stuff and here's how we got why we got the money. It's like, whatever. We're going to try to do the great stuff. You'll see it when it happens. You know, stay tuned is kind of how I feel.
You know what? Have you changed your attitude because of the flack you got from people who were asking, are you crazy? Because it seems like it. Like, I almost feel like you're apologizing for even wearing sunglasses at a conference when, to me, the attitude that you three have is one of the most exciting parts of your company.
I don't, you know, I have no regrets. You know, I think at the time, you know, I felt a little differently about it. I mean, my feeling on it is I think it is very important to, like, not take yourself seriously. Like, I think you've got to crack jokes, and I've seen, I mean, I haven't been through that much. I don't want to say, like, I've been through a lot, but I've been through some things, and I've seen some crazy things happen in this whole Rap Genius arc, and that has made me feel like it's very important not to take yourself too seriously. Now, the other side of the coin to that is you have to take your work very seriously, because, like, I think, you know, why are we here? Like, doing this stuff, like, the work is the thing, you know, and this goes beyond just, like, me wanting to build a project. This is how I think about relationships, how I think about friendships. Like, I think the best way to relate to other people, to hang out with your friends, is to be involved in a group project with them. You know, like, you're spending all your time working, you know, so why don't you spend all your time with your friends? And when you're sharing a struggle with someone, that's how you get a deep bond with that person. So, you know, work I take very, very seriously, you know, it pervades, like, my life. And so the problem is when you put on a display where you're sort of not taking yourself seriously, you risk people thinking you don't take the work seriously. And so, you know, you know, I think if you know me, if you've been at Rap Genius and then you see me do something silly, you're going to get one idea. But if you've never met me before, if you've never come to Rap Genius and hung out with, you know, the talented, you know, editors and contributors and engineers here, and you see some display on TechCrunch, it's rough, you're going to get a wrong idea. And that's sad. Like, I wish I could just crack a ton of jokes. Because that's how
Is that the part that really hurt you? It doesn't feel like it was a TechCrunch part. It was something else that made you change. Was it Google banning you? What is it? Because I am sensing a different person.
I don't know. I'm just trying to figure out the right way to convey to the world, you know, what Rap Genius is about, which is tricky.
Gotcha.
We are, you know, jokesters in a lot of ways. Like, we are not, like, the site has a lot of jokes. Jokes are in the culture, you know. I don't take myself very seriously, but that's combined with a very much of an obsessiveness about close reading and textual analysis, which is a weird combination to have in one person, in a group of people, in a company culture, and, like, expressing that expressing the multitudes we contain, like, figuring out a way to express that is kind of like the journey that we're going through. And, you know, I think we've kind of gone too far in one direction, and then we're going to go back and try to reach, like, a happy, you know, a happy medium.
And by the way, it's more than the sunglasses, more than the clothes that you wore, it's more than the phone on stage. It was the things that you've said. And frankly, I'm not even going to get into it because I don't think I could do it justice. And that's the part that draws me to you guys as much as the freaking work. And I shouldn't ever impose my point of view on an interview. I should try to bring out from you more of your thinking, more of who you are. But as a fan of the site, as a fan of your personality, as a fan of someone who both grew up loving music and guys like the Beastie Boys who are irreverent and business, the combination of the two that I see in you guys makes me feel like, this is the way I want to live my life. Just not exactly saying the things you say, not looking like you do, but being myself the way that you are and pushing it and having fun with it.
Well, I appreciate that.
You know what? I got to get off my soapbox. Let's end it with this. Here's something that I didn't expect at all. We always ask guests, do you have any books that you recommend? Because the audience asked for them. Most people have one book that they recommend. You gave us four different books, different kinds of books. I should probably talk about one, but I have to go through all of them for a reason.
Sure.
The first one for tech, you said Code Complete. Why?
So Code Complete I read way back when I first started programming on the referral of Jeff Atwood. It's funny because Jeff Atwood is an aside. Like, Jeff Atwood is a bit of a hero of mine. A big inspiration for Rap Genius was Stack Overflow, and I kind of sublimely got inspired by listening to every single Stack Overflow podcast. So, you know, that was sick. And it's funny because Jeff Atwood is like a Rap Genius like hater, and he's like, you know, tweets like anti-Rap Genius stuff. And he's the one hater who I can't totally just let go off my back. Like, I'm like, no, Jeff, don't hate me. So, Jeff, please don't hate me. I love you, dog. You're a true inspiration to me. But you inspired me to read Code Complete. What Code Complete taught me was what software engineering is about. Because when people think, and when I used to think about computer programming, I would think about, like, algorithms. Like, okay, what computer programming, what software engineering is about is coming up with a better algorithm to, like, sort a list or do something else. And what Code Complete taught me is that algorithms is totally a red herring. It's not what software engineering is about at all. What software engineering is about is building complicated systems. They're easy to maintain. And so one principle of Code Complete that I remember is, like, a well-designed piece of software is one where you can make a change in one area with minimal knowledge of other pieces of functionality across the system. And, like, stuff like that really, like, taught, like, was an eye-opening experience in terms of what software engineering actually is versus what I originally perceived it to be.
You know, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to bring this up, because the way you think comes through so much in your book recommendations, much more than I think any other question that I could ask. For management, you said the hard things about hard things. Why?
Ben Horowitz's new book. You know, I'm biased, obviously, because I've, you know, Ben's on our board, and I've heard a lot of, like, sort of, you know, other versions of these stories and other stories. But yeah, I mean, Ben Horowitz is someone who is down to talk about the fact that when you're trying to do the entrepreneurship thing, you're going to cry. You're going to puke. You're going to throw up. You are literally going to throw up. It is so hard.
Have you literally thrown up?
I have thrown up, absolutely.
What made you throw up?
You know, I don't know. Maybe I haven't actually thrown up. I've thrown up. Like stress of, like, probably during, like, a fundraising type situation. Like, that is when the, you know, that is when, like, fundraising is one time where you can really seem like, we're great, we're screwed, we're great, we're screwed. You know, during the Google thing, I didn't throw up during the Google thing, but I definitely experienced a lot of throw up type sweating patterns. But yeah, all kinds of stuff, you know, and Ben,
Google, like, Bandu. So does Ben make entrepreneurs throw up and then he writes a book about how you have to throw up?
Well, he's just down to be real about the human side of this thing, which is there's a very emotional human core to all of this, and you have to pay attention to that. And so when you walk in to, you know, give someone a, you know, so first of all, Ben is big on, like, you know, the talking, the communication aspect, which you have to appreciate, like one-on-ones. Like, Ben was influential in my thinking on this, which is, like, you've got to do one-on-ones. You manage someone, you've got to do at least a bi-weekly one-on-one where you meet with them once every 2 weeks at least, maybe once every week, and you have an agenda, but at the end and throughout, you say, how do you feel? How do you really feel? Like, what else is on your mind? Like, you try to get people to say what they're really thinking. And what they're really thinking isn't like, oh, I'm wrestling with this hard code problem. What they're really thinking is, you know, the person who sits next to me is making me feel weird, and this other thing, and I feel weird about you, and, like, let's talk about, like, getting to the bottom of the emotional core of, like, what's actually going on in business, even though people pretend that, like, it's not.
The emotional core.
Yeah, it's a big
yes,
part.
Yes, that's one of my problems as an interviewer. People pretend that it's not. I'll talk to them on camera, and they'll pretend that it's not. I will invite them afterwards to the office for scotch night, and sometimes they drink water, no scotch. Yeah. So it's not just the alcohol, and then they open up about that. I'll work on it. I've got time here. Let's do two others real quick. Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. Why?
I love David Foster Wallace, first of all. Like, that's, you know, obviously his meme book, but, you know, David Foster Wallace just mirrors a lot of my, like, passions, you know, like, complicated fiction, you know, the English language, like, what was the essay he wrote on that review of Garner's Modern American Usage? I forget the name of it, but that was really great.
I don't know that.
And also he has this great interest in the philosophy of logic and the philosophy of math. He wrote this book, Everything and More, which is a good book, but also, like, math. So I, like, really have, you know, a lot of intellectual interest in common with David Foster Wallace. And, you know, the book Infinite Jest, is this flawed, you know, monster masterpiece. But, first of all, it's just very, very readable, very, very funny. And then also just, like, this subliminal idea of, like, footnotes and annotation and context. You know, like, this is this book that has hundreds of footnotes. We need two bookmarks to read it. And so, like, just David Foster Wallace's obsession with footnotes, and this comes up in Everything and More as well. You know, I think subliminally that kind of got the, you know, the juices, the gears turning in my head about, like, annotation. Now, of course, Infinite Jest is not the same thing because the annotations are still part of the text. The annotations still exist within the fictional world. And so, you know, if David Foster Wallace were to do verified annotations, they'd be written by the author, David Foster Wallace, who's explaining stuff about the work, whereas the annotations, the footnotes in Infinite Jest are still within the text. So it's a little different, but still just breaking stuff down, like, you know, you take a little thing and then a little footnote and then this huge expanse, this huge thing, like, where you can really cash out what's going on, like, that idea.
I could understand now why you considered being a lawyer.
Right.
Yes. All right, the final one is a book I've been wanting to read ever since, I guess, college, when a friend of mine started reading it, The Power Broker, but it's so long that it's intimidating, and it's not directly applicable to business, but it is still a very intellectual book that I think, when am I going to have time to go through The Power Broker? You're reading it now. You're about halfway through. Why?
Well, first of all, just a quick admission, I'm listening to the audiobook.
Even the audio, frankly, even the audiobook intimidated me because of the size. What is it? It's a 50-hour book, right?
It's more than that. It's like 60 or 70 hours. It's very, very, very long. Intimidating. It's hard now because since I live in the building in which I work, I don't have a commute, and I used to listen to it on the subway. But yeah, it's a great book. You know, it's about, you know, sort of
the man who shaped New York.
Man who shaped New York. You know, go look at the West Side Highway sometime. You know, go drive any parkway. Okay, like, for real. But, you know, I think part of what The Power Broker teaches you is kind of, you know, techniques in obtaining power, in applying power. You know, one great thing, you know, from that book is this idea of how Robert Moses would get the money to build, like, a, you know, Jones Beach Recreation Center or whatever. What he would do is he'd say, give me $1 million. That's all I need for the project. And then he would break ground and he would start building and he'd spend $1 million and nothing. He'd go back and say, okay, I broke ground, I started building. Turns out I need $20 million. The legislature, $1 million. And then, you know, Robert Moses was basically implicitly or explicitly say, look, what, are you going to cut off my funding and now the $1 million is going to go to waste and you're going to look like idiots because you approved the project without knowing? So, like, you know, put the shovel in the ground is kind of his idea. And I think there's some, there's a lot of truth to that. But more than about, like, obtaining power and applying power is the lesson of just, like, you know, what kind of person, you know, does it turn you into? So, like, if you look at Robert Moses and, you know, the type of, you know, person he was, both in the sort of the intensity of his drive and how that made him deal with people, you know, on the job and in his professional life, but also, like, look at the way he treated his brother, you know, and, like, how calculating and cold he was in that thing. And it's like, you know, was he, like, ultimately, like, happy? Is that a good way to live? And I think about this in business a lot because, like, especially when you're dealing in a with people outside of your company, whether it's a vendor or an investor or, you know, a counterparty to some deal, the right approach is often to be very, very ruthless and push very, very hard and advocate, you know, very aggressively for your own interests. And that is a hard thing to learn, especially if you're fundamentally, like, a nice person, which I think I basically am. Like, I'm not trying to be mean. So you have to train yourself to be really, really, really ruthless. But the even more challenging thing is being able to do that in a business context without warping your brain into becoming like a ruthless, upset, mad person. Like, you know, if you have to work yourself up to get angry to negotiate with someone, and then you're done negotiating and you go talk to your friend, you're not going to be able to totally become unangry. And or maybe you can, and then that also is creepy to some people. Like, you know, I will, you know, I'll be in a mode where I'll give someone extremely harsh feedback on something, and then see the person an hour later at, like, a company event and be totally friendly with the person. That freaks people out. But, like, being able to, like, do, you know, and so, like, just thinking about that and, like, what is the right way to orient yourself towards this thing, given that, you know, you can't, to be successful, you can't just be nice to everyone all the time, but you probably don't want to turn into someone like Robert Moses, who was just 100% ruthless and total animal, but shaped New York. So
there it is. In the end, his legacy is still there. Hey, before I end, I want to say thank you to a Mixergy premium member. The premium members are the ones who keep this thing going. In return for keeping this going, I give them the best freaking courses and interviews, the most research, the most prepared for that I possibly can. And I want to thank one of them. Mitch Roth is a Mixergy premium member and has been for a while. He says, when I asked him why he's a premium member, he said, or what he got out of it, he said, I was able to gain confidence that I too can play a role of an entrepreneur and strike out on my own adventure. That's one of the things that I got out of reading biographies when I started in business and still do to this day. And I'm so proud that I can contribute that to Mitch and to all these premium members. If you're not a premium member, go sign up at MixergyPremium.com. Hey, Tom, how cool would it be if one day this whole interview, the transcript of it, could be annotated? Like every part, including like the part where I didn't ask a question all the way through and someone could explain what I was getting at, or where I didn't quote what you were saying but someone could explain what I was – I would love that.
Let's do it. For real. I mean, I think on your site, right, you have the transcripts there.
Yeah, so, I'll give you the transcript, but I don't know that anyone would care about this. You know, one of my disappointments is the kind of music that I'm passionate about. When I go to Rap Genius, there's not enough on there. I almost would rather people would focus on, like, the old – what trips me up? Like, I'll suddenly get into heavy metal. An old heavy metal wouldn't necessarily be complete. I would love for people even to complete that before they get to Mixergy, but if they could annotate Mixergy, oh, I would love it.
Let's do it. You know, I mean, you know, if you were interviewing, you know, Kanye West, it would definitely get annotated, or Obama, it would definitely get heavily annotated. With me, maybe less so, but I'm going to throw some annotation. Like, we can put some verified annotations on there. So, you know, if someone watches the show, if you're watching this right now, how about that? If you're watching this right now, head over to Rap Genius and search for it, and you'll see the behind the scenes stuff.
I would love that, and I will come in and I will annotate along with people, but I'd like someone else in the audience or someone in the audience to help get this going, so it's not like my project just for myself. I want to see that they care, but I would love that. I think that there's room to go beyond music into annotating thoughts. What did we miss? What didn't we get into? And you guys are welcome to copy this and do whatever you want with this. Thank you so much for doing this interview. I've been a big fan. I ran over when I saw that you were on the agenda right now because I freaking love the product. Love the product.
I appreciate that. Thanks. Well, you know, I appreciate the love and you know, I appreciate You know, I appreciate that you like some of the crazy vibes we put out in the past, and you know, there's more craziness
to come. Say in the past. It hurts me to hear that. It hurts me to hear that. It feels
recently and not so recently, but more craziness is to come. I promise.
I would like that. I mean, I just don't want to see this rap genius. I think the founders. This is. I don't care if it sounds like I'm kissing butt. There's no reason for doing it because we're at the end of freaking interview. I think people are missing the point. I think if you're really into music, I think if you're specifically maybe into the kind of music I am. There's a meaning behind music, you know, and when there isn't music meaning, I don't give a rat's ass about it, but when there's meaning about it, it's a form of self-expression, a form of inner depth, a form of leaving your mark on the world, and when I see the way that you guys carry yourselves, I feel like you're doing it, and no more than you can say the Beastie Boys stink because of this line that they said about girls should do the laundry. You can't analyze them based on that. You have to take them complete with who they are, the time they're in, and the message that they have to communicate, and I feel the same thing needs to be done with entrepreneurs, and frankly, if you guys start to hold back, what the hell's the point for the rest of us, right?
Sure, it's our responsibility. I'll
please carry that responsibility to the whole. Otherwise, we're all dead.
Woo!
Yes. All right. Thank you so much for doing this interview.
Oh, it was great. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Thank you. Thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, guys.